Bet365 is paying out before the final whistle.
Check out Bet365's unrivaled early payout offer. When you bet on a team to win and they take a 17-point lead, you get paid no matter the final score. Forget the final whistle and start counting that cash. Hold up. You get early payout on parlays, too.
Download the app and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.
Steve, are you familiar with Alien Earth?
Could you sum it up real quick? I probably could figure it out.
Yeah, I think I could sum it up pretty quick. There are some aliens and they come to Earth.
Oh, so it's like Alf.
There are some cats in the show for sure.
It's just a shot-for-shot remake, dude. I don't know what anybody's talking about.
Moro is Mrs. Offmonic.
Yeah, totally. Everybody. There's no way the dad on there wasn't a synth, right? He had no emotions.
Of course.
Oh, Alf, don't eat the cat. Oh.
So because we've been helping the Lorehounds cover season one of Alien Earth, notably episodes 5 and 6, we thought we'd take some feedback. So we'll jump back into our Bacon Wrap season next week with Memoirs of the Invisible Man.
Oh, boy.
This pod here, we'll be answering listener feedback and... then at the end of that, we will be re-airing our earlier coverage of the original Alien.
Oh.
So people have that to look forward to. Do you remember recording that podcast?
I know we did it. I was a younger man.
Yeah. I mean, you were really fixated on Sigourney Weaver's underwear. I did a little...
And who wouldn't be? It's just, I mean, this it kind of shows the limits of technology.
They hadn't invented fabric that could cover an entire woman's ass.
There were no tape measures of any sort in this particular version of the future.
All right. Okay, I'm going to jump right into listener feedback here. This is from Kim. I knew Boy Wonder was behind all that chaos. He murdered a whole bunch of his own citizens. I have a feeling that he's going to suffer a Joffrey Baratheon-type death. Everyone's just going to be rooting for him to go down. Keep up the good work. I appreciate and love y'all. Well, we love you too, Kim.
Who do you think she loves the least?
Me. I mean, that's...
You think so?
I mean, she said that in the email. A lot of these emails...
That's what she signs off.
P.S. I love Anthony the least. A lot of these emails have been truncated by me. I take full credit for that. I just decided I would pick out the part of the email that I thought you and I might want to respond to and then pretend like it was the entire email.
Ah, okay, good.
All right, so that's what we're going to do. Same Kim, I believe, sent another email. She says she has a prediction for future internet points. Kid Cavalier is going to die by the eyeball octopus. I would like to see that. I mean, I honestly don't know if that kills him. Like, if the eye took over Boy K, does that kill Boy K?
It doesn't. Because so can the eye.
Will that sheep? Will that sheep continue to eat without an eye once the. Once the image has departed.
It's not just plugging. I think it's plugging into their brains, right? So then that, I imagine that's invasive.
Yeah. I mean, it's a little bit like going to a Coldplay concert in that way.
Invasive?
It gets in your brain.
It gets in your brain, and regardless of what you, no matter what you do, you'll always have that memory, good or bad.
You'll be like, do I like Coldplay now? I don't know. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's like, I had a good time at the concert, but was it despite Coldplay or because of?
So, yeah, it's an interesting problem. I don't know if... It's not like it has to, like, kill you to take control over you. It's in your eyeball. You can live without an eyeball, right?
Right, but it's manipulating your entire body, which means it has to be attaching itself to your brain.
Are you not listening? That's just like a Coldplay concert. Do I have to repeat myself every time? So you're saying The image kills you when it takes control.
I mean, so we've seen it leave bodies.
Yes, that's right.
And they don't go do things, I don't think, afterwards.
Okay, that's a good question. Was the cat just dead? Did we see the cat's corpse afterwards?
I don't know. I don't recall. I wasn't paying attention to that type of thing at that point.
Yeah. See, I don't know. It's a good question. Like, if the image took control of Boy K, and let's say he ran his company for 4 or 5 years, when it decides...
Or just Boy K is just eating hay. It's like... It's not quite sure what the, like, it was in the sheep for so long that it's just like, this is all I really know.
All right. So anyway, Kim, if the image does kill Boy K, you get all the internet points. This next email comes from Tobias. One important aspect I haven't heard discussed is whether Marcy is dead or not. Is Wendy just a copy of Marcy's person? We could probably already train an AI to mimic a human convincingly, but we are nowhere near the ability to transfer consciousness. All the best, Tobias. So what do you think? Is Joe really talking to Marcy? Or is he talking to something that was based on Marcy?
Yeah, that's. I keep thinking that. I keep wondering that same thing. Because I'm trying to, I guess... This is the newer technology, right? I mean, this is the hybrid is the new thing, but isn't that what it says in the beginning, the first episode? Doesn't it say that a hybrid, is it human consciousness in?
Oh, that's a good point. The opening title card did kind of explain what a hybrid was.
Yeah.
I'm wondering if we take that as sort of like gospel truth, or we take that as like Prodigy's pamphlets that they hand out. I mean, I'd like, for my enjoyment of the show, I like the idea that it is Marcy in there and she's evolved. You know, she's not the same person she was before, but there is some kind of continuity of personality. But that doesn't necessarily mean that that's true.
Yeah, so the definition of hybrids are another android type created by the Prodigy Corporation. Synthetic body outfitted with a human consciousness downloaded from the mind of a different being. So the question I think then becomes is like, does something happen in the download? Right? Is a download just a pure... Because that's my understanding of this is that it's human consciousness, but it does... To the degree that it's Marcy, I think is maybe questionable. Like it's the consciousness of Marcy. What happens when this is maybe even a deeper question that I don't know if the series is going to tackle or not, but extracting consciousness in and of itself is just, it's fanciful. So what, is it a simple one for one? Can you just take your, because then I guess the idea is consciousness is a bit more abstract than just taking whatever is functioning in your brain and putting it into a synthetic brain. Because I think the idea of consciousness brings in a whole, that starts to bring in things like ego and, just deeper levels, right? If there's a consciousness and there's a subconscious, does that transfer over? And if there's a consciousness, but there's no subconsciousness, is that truly the consciousness from Marcy? Is it missing something? You know, so I think there is... Right. I think it's truly a consciousness. I personally, just the way that I'm reading the title card and the intent of what a hybrid is that it's supposed to complicate the order of these creations that we've made, right? The cyborg, the synth, and the hybrid is supposed to be that, like, okay, well, this should be, rather than just being human and machine combined, let's take the synthetic body, which we see as replaceable and better. And this sort of becomes the whole immortality concept. It's like, if you could just keep on swapping out your body and maintain your consciousness, then you could live forever. Now that suggests that there isn't, you know, brain rot and all of that other stuff, but it's...
So one of the things that you just said that I thought was really interesting is what's missing. Like was there any part of Marcy that failed to transfer into Wendy. Because you could imagine, like, yeah, they mapped it pretty well, and they got 90% of it, or they got 97% of it, or whatever. And now it's being approximated in this, you know, artificial intelligence. To me, it's like, well, what was lost in the transfer, and how much would you have to lose for it not to be the same person?
The very fact that they can manipulate their ages and what they can remember would suggest that they could take that consciousness and then sort of remap it, right? Like, even if you got 100% of it, it could be a matter of what are they deciding to turn on? What are they deciding to turn off? Have enough memory. Like, because going back to the show, we made some Severance connections just in terms of, you know, some of the structure and visuals. But that's the same thing about Severance, right? That these people aren't just like completely blank slates. They know that a walrus exists, but they might not be able to draw one. And so they know that they know that there is an outside. They just haven't personally seen it, you know. So they have they don't have any memories, but they have awareness. And so I think they can manipulate that. And so which then begs the question: well, why not take off the part that wants family?
That's interesting.
Why not undo that part? Like, so that's it. So the question is that just inevitability of a conscious transfer? Is that a something they didn't take account for, or is that necessary for maybe what they're trying to do, right? Because like this with the idea that like, oh, it was it Nibs thought she was pregnant, so they were like they wanted to eliminate that whole imagination around that, whereas they haven't done that with Wendy. They haven't you know, could have been easier just to be like, well, just don't have her pine for her family or her brother and be done with it.
I guess one of the in-world clues to answer Tobias's question is, what does Boy K think? He seems to have devoted a lot of time and energy and money into making this transfer. And so if it's not really, if it's just an approximation, is it worth doing? But the other thing about this is that he hasn't transferred himself yet.
That we know of.
You're right, that we know, now we're dealing with Westworld again. Right, so that we know of, he has not transferred himself yet, and it seems like he's using these kids as guinea pigs for some outcome that we don't see yet. So, anyway, I mean, my thought on this, my thought on the end game is, now that we have these other creatures, is there a way to use part of what we learn from these alien physiologies? Right. He's interested in hybrids.
If you see the xenomorph as a perfect physical specimen, could you move a human consciousness into it and create the perfect, whether it be weapon or just a specimen altogether?
Right. Or use the information that you get from the xenomorph to sort of upgrade the next toy. So anyway, good question. Good question, Tobias. So we got two voice notes, Steve, and I thought for the purpose of saving time, I'd play them both to you at the same time.
No, perfect.
Shane from the city calling in. First off, episode 5, terrific. It was like Alien 2.0. Everyone's kind of complaining. I mean, not everyone, but I see people complain about the writing or about these characters being stupid. Yeah, they're stupid. They're in space for years. They're like lethargic. Their brains aren't working as fast. I just thought it was great. Good episode. The image is just horrendously terrifying. Boy case feet are disgusting. I don't care how smart you are. Put some shoes on, bro. Or at least put some socks.
I think the only way to answer this is if we answer them both at the same time.
Yeah, so you and I think so. I think Shane is the guy with the sort of the younger, higher voice. Mm-hmm. And Brian is the one with sort of the lower dad voice. Mm-hmm. I'll answer Brian's question and you answer Shane's question.
Okay.
3, 2, 1.
Brian, yeah, so I think you've got a good point. Shantin, and thanks for calling in. It's really important that
space is going to affect your ability.
You're right. I do think that there is something to be said for be able to do much maybe Kirsch in space is in fact
if you have brain damage, affected,
which brings up a whole new set of questions about whether or not.
In addition to that, I think that we should understand that
money have is enough relative. Artificial intelligence.
You're not
or
going
whatever is
to
downloaded that they
view a billion dollars the same way if you're a trillionaire. And yet, if you're an indentured
or,
servant, you might be able to do a lot.
Eventual
might
sense,
be able
right?
to
I mean,
want
they are
to
self-serving.
Do a lot.
They're survivalists.
You are
but it would be kind of an interesting twist
dollars.
If they
you might
at least
leave your family behind.
At the very least, we find out that synths have passive aggression.
So I appreciate the voice notes from Brian and Shane. Don't be strangers. Send us a lot of those. All right, Steve. Abby writes, about this Xeno, we see the same one. Is this the same one Wendy dispatched? So this is the Xenomorph who kills everyone in episode 5. And then crashes to Earth. Do we think that that is the same one that we saw Wendy kill in episode 4?
Oh. I think I had assumed so. What did you think?
I assume so too. I mean, it's possible that it's not. I thought how could it not what would be the possibility that it wasn't? And I thought the body of who is the space trucker guy?
Oh, yeah, I know what you're talking about. I forget his name.
So yeah, the space trucker mechanic guy. The image took control of his body through the eye and then left his body behind. I could imagine because these xenomorphs breed so fast that body becomes, an incubator for another one. So it could be that they didn't get all of the xenomorphs in this
Do
case.
Do we know, and this is, and maybe this is something that I would know better if I saw all the movies or read the book. Can a Xeno with the face hugger, incubation, can it do it with a corpse? Does it have to be a living host? Because I would, that's kind of my thought is that because it keeps it alive, but then
I think it has to be living.
Yeah.
I think it has to be alive.
Because I think that's part of the horror of it, right? Is that these people are alive and, but like to what end, right?
Right. All right, so Abby continues. Seems like it is selective with its victims. Does it feel if someone's on a contract and plays with them a little bit longer, like lets them run, versus if someone is playing a rich asshole and then it's like total destruction in seconds? It didn't toy much with that Tang fella either, who was not a synth after all. Maybe it has a creep radar.
I like that. How much Alien versus Predator are you familiar with?
Zero.
Okay, so I've seen one. I never saw, Requiem or something. I know that these, they live in the same universe and there are rules for Predator. Right? I mean, Predator, essentially, the Predators attack that which are legit threats, right? Like they're armed.
They only attack actors who will eventually become governors of the United States.
Good news for Adrian Brody. I'm wondering if, because the Xenomorph, I think a lot of times is considered just sort of this like killing machine and blah blah blah. But there appears to be some sort of, whether it's code or whether it's some sort of decision making on its own. I think David may have intimated that he thought it was depending on how full they were.
Oh, interesting.
Like if they're like not particularly hungry, they might play with their food. And I wonder if that's also has something to do with where they are in their life cycle. Like, are the younger ones more apt to be, more just go, kill, and then later the other ones are a little more strategic. It's interesting. I'm sure there's information out there on this, and
I'm sure that the internet will come to our rescue. It's always been my assumption that there is some kind of fear response that they want from their victims. It's not like they just always attack. That little mouth comes out of the big jaws, right?
Yeah.
And people freak out. And I do think that there's a sense in which there's an instinct to chase and there's an instinct to feed, and it wants the whole experience. And part of that is to, like, I want to smell your fear before I do this. So I mean, these things are not machines, they're animals, and animals do, they do things like that. Like,
true. Like,
who can know the mind of a cat, for instance?
Ours is not the question one.
So anyway, all interesting questions, Abby. Next one from Sub-Zero. I love that they are giving each hybrid a distinct path. So I thought this would be a good moment to kind of chart out who these Lost Boys are and where they are in the story. All right. Mm-hmm. So we have Wendy. All right. So Wendy's just realized that she is also a specimen, or she's known it for a while, but now it kind of bugs her in a way that it didn't before. I think the seed has been planted in her to leave the island because of Joe. And so I think that she's on her trajectory to make that happen. Also, we know that her internal tracker has been turned off, right?
Right.
So it feels like the show is telling us, okay, this is sort of the next adventure. We have Nibs. Nibs has had a memory wipe. And also sort of an identity alteration. But she's, I think, on a path to knowing that they tinkered with her. And then the question is, how is she going to react to that?
Well, and she was so like threatening for a while, right? For that one episode in particular, like there was this glimpse into what happens if things aren't copacetic.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so there is definitely the, like, you know, again, going back to the notion of, like, they're all specimens as well, is like there is a, well, what if they don't work out? Or what if there's a glitch?
What if there's a glitch?
Are all consciousnesses the same? And the idea is, no, right? I mean,
what if there's a glitch, but also what if there's a glitch that the humans interpret as a personality defect, but the body is functioning as a superhuman machine? I think that's the question we're asking with Nibs.
Right.
I mean, look, here's a question. If these children decided to kill everyone on the island, how long would it take?
Right. Right.
Like, would it take that long? I don't know. I don't know whether, I mean, I don't know if they have like some kind of kill switch or whatever. Like Boy K's got like a safe word or something.
Like a Tesla.
Do Teslas have safe words?
I always assume that at any point, there'll be an uprising.
Oh, okay. All right. Toodles is dead. Sorry, Toodles.
For now.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. We could deal with an issue of, you know, Toodles 2.0. Mm-hmm. So we have slightly Adarsh, who is now hiding in a vent or creeping through a vent at some point with a human body, a human incubator that has a xenomorph inside of it. And he must have some kind of rendezvous point with Moro. I think that's the plan, right?
Yeah, I would assume so.
Or is Moro like, just get him on the edge of the island and I'll fly in and swoop? I don't know what the plan is. Maybe this is the plan. Maybe they don't want to get him off the island necessarily. It's just that you get that xenomorph out. Now the xenomorph is going to completely wreck the island.
Right.
And then you swoop in.
If there's an evacuation, then there's an entrance that is created, right?
Yeah, maybe that's it. Okay, I like it. Okay, next one is Smee. Smee is, he doesn't have a lot to do. Smee is sort of like destined to be picked last at dodgeball. I don't know what his story arc is going to be. Curly's interesting to me. She didn't have a lot to do the last couple episodes, but in the previous one, she was sort of setting herself up to be the new favorite.
Right, right.
And so that's kind of setting up a rivalry with her and Wendy. Yeah, you could imagine that Boy K is sort of the mastermind. He's the big boss. And that finally, you know, when Wendy wants to take him down, she's got to go through Curly or something.
Yeah,
like
I can
that.
See that.
So Curly and Wendy might be on a collision course in that way.
Yeah, it feels like that was getting set up for that.
All right. So I appreciate you giving us the opportunity to sort of map that out there, Sub-Zero. He goes on, I'm wondering if the hybrids are even capable of emotionally growing into adults. There's growth that comes with experience, but there are also hormonal balance changes that impact maturity. We talked a little bit about that last podcast. And we can see each of them struggling in their own ways. So, yeah, I think if, unfortunately, I don't know if we're going to see more of that theme this season. If this is a 5-season arc, they're definitely going to deal with that. But at this point, it feels like the chaos is underway, and now the character development is just going to be a reaction to the chaos. That is my sense of these things.
Yeah, I think it's really going to depend on how much of this vision they're going to get behind in terms of show running, because I've seen this with other shows where it's like it's got a longer arc, but they only give them a little bit of runway. Mm. So then you kind of have to accelerate the action to kind of get to that ending really soon, right?
Sure. This is from Jessica. About Moro's hand, Peter started his whole feud with Hook by cutting off Hook's hand and feeding it to the crocodile. I wonder if this metaphor will extend to the show somehow, or if Boy K sabotaging Moro's ship is the metaphor here. I don't know why I didn't make this connection before.
I know, me too. I'm an idiot.
I mean, it's like the Peter Pan stuff is like,
because I've been thinking of Captain Hook the whole time, and I'm wondering, and I'm like, I wonder who the Hook character is. Like, well, maybe the guy with the hook for a hand.
They've been hitting me over the head with this Peter Pan stuff.
Completely disqualified myself from any more commentary on this show.
So thank you, Jessica. Neither Steve or I had even considered the hook analogy.
What the hell is wrong with me? My God.
Oh, it's really funny. I mean, there's probably 10 other things like that we missed, right?
I'm going to find out. Like, remember the whole episode about crocodiles? What?
Tinkerbell is in every scene. Didn't you see Tinkerbell?
That's the image.
Okay, this is the last one. This is from Mark. If your email was sent and not read, it says nothing about the value of the content of your email. It's because I think I'm better than you. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And so I
can vouch for his arrogance.
Yeah, yeah. So, sorry about that.
He comes by it honestly.
This is from Mark. He says he likes the show. There's a lot about him liking the show. He says, however, not to nitpick, but I was struck by a thread that Steve and Anthony chose to leave there, despite being perhaps the path to the most unique conversation in human history. In your discussion with David, you two were faced with an opportunity to talk to someone who had played the first Street Fighter game, and only the first Street Fighter game. David made his outlandish claim, and you two left it there. You didn't ask for clarification, didn't query in disbelief. The moment passed, and such a moment was a chance to converse with one of the rarest people who's ever walked the earth. Ah, to have a discussion. No three humans in history has ever had. Don't you see that it's too late now? No one can ask him about it. How could they? To bring up a Street Fighter randomly apropos of nothing while there's a great show to talk about? It would be totally absurd, right? It would be a true waste of everyone's time. So, I guess, number one, my apologies. Clearly, David's claim that he had only ever played the first Street Fighter and had no knowledge of Street Fighter 2 is bizarre.
It is bizarre.
We should have asked him about it for sure.
Yeah, we left meat on the bone. There's no question about it. And I think personally, I knew in my heart of hearts that if if this was a properly Howard joint exclusively, we would have forgotten what we were there for originally.
I mean, I guess part of this is...
I was sitting there. There was a point where when he was referring to Dalzim as like one of these way later creations that I was like, we need to have a timeout.
sure. Yeah.
And again, I think, and I think the point is very, or at least implied in this feedback, and I think it's really worth exploring, is a lot of people, when they refer to Street Fighter II, specifically Street Fighter II Championship Edition. I think it's because that was the one, I think, that mm-hmm. really grabbed people. That's the one that you would go to. Mm-hmm. Street Fighter, the original, was probably somewhere in the, maybe, like, you'd give it a shot at a 7-Eleven, you know what I mean? Like a Bad Dudes mm-hmm. or, you know, not, like it's like you would find Bump and Jump at a Foster Freeze.
This is sort of before Vega, right? Before Vega.
Yeah. So then you get in Street Fighter II, and I wonder if it's a timing thing, you know, like when, like it just, it grabbed people at the right time and people understood that you could fight each other. And then there were more advanced moves, and, you know, cause then you have like the Tekken crowd, and of course you've got the Mortal Kombat's. If you revisited Street Fighter I, it's slower. It's, you know, whatever, it's the original. And so I think there is something to be said for there's a conversation to be had, but you're right. That time is gone. That time has passed. We're essentially edging, and here we are. You know, that's one of the things about edging, is that you're you know, in the moment you think that it's going somewhere, but you know deep down it's not, and then you never can go back.
For me, it was sort of like, have you ever met someone that you think might be a serial killer, and then they say something that you're like, oh no, that guy's totally a serial killer? For me, that was it. Like, I've always kind of suspected David as a serial killer, but when he said that, I don't think that I could sort of process that information in a way in real time that would allow me to have the conversation. I think I just kind of put it out of my mind. I was like, I can't deal.
I'm not ready for the reason.
I'm not ready for the reason.
Because the thing is, as you think about it, is that like if you go from a Street Fighter introduction and then you have no knowledge of even Street Fighter II Champion Edition, I immediately wonder, where did you have to go?
So this is
why did you have to be where this wasn't? That suggests
right.
Either a consciousness blackout, uh-huh. which is a problem, or an actual physical removal, whether by force or by choice, that says I can't be in this space with uh-huh. other people anymore. And that's
David's the villain in Split with several personalities. And it seems like one of those personalities just kind of took over for the entire 90s.
Right.
And I don't know which personality I was talking to in that podcast, to be honest. So
no, that's why we always treat him a little cautiously. Very careful with them.
So yeah, you're totally right, Mark. This is not a topic that we can ever bring up with David again, for all the reasons we just stated. So thank you for your feedback. We're going to continue to enjoy this show. We might talk about it in another venue. I don't know, but as of now, stick around and enjoy Steve and I's coverage of the original 79 Alien.
Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $200 into something bigger when you bet on Moneyline, Spread, Totals, Player Props.
$200 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In app only.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
Welcome to Cocoons of Horror, the podcast that revisits classic horror films and other pulp fiction. Today we take a look at Ridley Scott's classic horror sci-fi film, Alien. This is a movie that has it all. The tension of being separated from home, corporate greed, bloodthirsty aliens, and fighting in tiny underwear. With me, as always, is Dr. Anthony Ladon.
Very nice. Well, let's just get into this. Let's get into this thing.
Okay.
Much like the film, the suspense is killing me here.
Steve, as you know, we are covering Alien today.
Yes.
Are you prepared for this?
I am prepared. I mean, to the degree that I've watched the movie very recently, yes. In terms of, like, you know, am I prepared for what may transpire from this conversation? I mean, who could be?
Well, the first question I have is, what is your relationship to this franchise?
Late adopter, similar to what we've talked about with Jaws. I think this may be my second time watching Alien all the way through. I have only up until maybe earlier this year seen the movie Aliens.
Really?
Wow. Yes. In fact, I think the first Alien movie I ever saw was Alien 3. I mean, I understood the notion of Alien. Had never seen the original Alien, nor had I seen Aliens, obviously. And we all got very high. I fell asleep very early.
And in Alien 3?
In Alien 3. And I woke up to the final scene. I won't spoil it because I don't want to spoil a movie that's probably like 30 years old.
Yeah, 30 years old. Well, for Game of Thrones fans, famously, Charles Dance is in Aliens 3. Do you remember? Do you remember that part?
Did he show up during the time when I was asleep?
Either asleep or high, yeah.
Well, yeah, that's easy. That was both in most cases. I know what Charles S. Dutton, am I correct in that? From TV shows Rock, R-O-C, isn't it?
You got me on that one.
Well, that was good. I just wanted to, I had to do something to take your Charles Dance knowledge down a notch.
Okay, so let me tell you my history here. As you know, I was not a huge fan of horror films growing up, but I had seen Aliens, plural, because I heard someone say it may be the best action film ever made. And, you know, this might have been in the 90s or whatever. But I thought, well, I should probably see this movie. So I had seen Aliens, plural. And in my mind, because my memory is faulty, Steve, I had convinced myself that I had seen Alien. I had not seen Alien until very recently.
Okay.
So I had thought, yeah, of course, Alien's awesome. I love Alien. And then I, you know, earlier this year, I thought I should revisit Alien. And I realized I have not seen this movie. Because I do not remember Ian Holm in this movie.
Right. Yeah, Alien considered horror. Everything within the everything under the sci-fi umbrella, right? Whereas Alien is considered horror. Mm-hmm. And Aliens is considered action.
Interesting, yeah. Because you could easily make a case that Aliens is horror as well.
It'd be probably a horror action, but I think if you were gonna do the hierarchy, I think action mm-hmm. more than like if you have a wheated bourbon, mm-hmm. for it to be a bourbon, it still must be at least 51% corn. But to be calling it wheated, it has to have your next highest mash bill being wheat. So this is mm-hmm. Maybe the question is this a horrored action or is this an actioned horror? Like, what would you consider it? I would put Aliens at probably 51% action.
Well, let's start with Alien because that's the one we're covering. So,
well, that makes sense. It makes sense to talk about the movie that we're actually here to talk about. I mean, that's why you're running lead on this. I feel like I'm doing play-by-play for a game we're not watching.
The way that this was marketed was absolutely a horror. This is 1979. We had seen a few space operas. You know, 1968 was 2001. Mm-hmm. The first Star Wars was in the wild. Then they marketed this film as Jaws in Space. And the trailer for this film famously said, it was just Alien, and the subtitle was, In Space, No One Can Hear You Scream. So yeah. To me, that means you're going to show me a horror flick. And I don't think that this movie disappoints as a horror flick.
No, not at all.
Now, Aliens, the second one, absolutely, certainly has some action aspects to it. And I'm thinking specifically of the final scene or the final fight scene or whatever, which maybe we shouldn't spoil. But, certainly has that feel to it.
How respectful are we that we don't want to spoil movies that are this old?
I know. We're quite something. You know, you and I.
Yeah.
Okay, so my only other anecdote about my relationship with the franchise is that a few years back, I was on the airplane, and I decided to watch Prometheus.
Uh-huh.
And I started watching the film on the plane. I don't know if you've ever watched a film on a plane, Steve, but it's a different kind of experience.
Mm-hmm.
It's never the same. It's never optimal.
I don't think you ever want to watch a movie for the first time on a plane.
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm watching this on the plane, and I'm thinking, this is a bad ripoff of Alien.
Not realizing that maybe it was an intentional connection.
It is part of canon. Right. So, and I did not know that. And I was just thinking, these assholes are just ripping off Alien.
they're even taking the director's name.
So judgy. Just so judgy about it. All right. Steve, do you have an elevator pitch for this movie?
Well, yeah. I mean, so the Jaws in Space was probably a really apt, like, and give credit to Jaws, right? Because like we talked about this, is just everything that happens anywhere is Jaws in, and same thing where like Die Hard. Die Hard was that way too, where all of a sudden it was like, you know, Speed was Die Hard on a bus.
Sure.
Under Siege was like Die Hard in a submarine. Mm-hmm. Die Hard 2 was Die Hard in a worse movie. Mm-hmm. So for Alien, I mean, it's my elevator pitch would probably be people you don't care about in an awful situation.
people you don't care about in an awful situation?
Yeah.
Is this because you're a dog guy and you don't like cats? Is that what this is?
I don't know if it's my relationship with Tom Skerritt.
I love Tom Skerritt. How do you not like Tom Skerritt?
I don't dislike Tom Skerritt, but I don't know that I've ever been moved by Tom Skerritt.
Oh, I'm a big River Runs Through It fan.
Oh, okay. See, to me, Tom Skerritt is
which is the anti-action movie. I don't know if you've ever seen a River Runs Through It, but it is as boring as it sounds.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Basically, a river's going to do what a river's going to do. It's going to be called Watching the Current. Tom Skerritt is like the Bob Seger of acting, like, which if it shows up, cool. I'm probably in. But like, let's say you're doing a music festival, mm-hmm. and Bob Seger is like the final act. That's probably not a great music festival. But if Bob Seger is like middle,
mm-hmm.
You might be into something here. And I feel like when Skerritt is like the lead guy.
Yeah.
I'm like, all right, I'm here for something else.
Okay, I'm going to push back on you.
Okay.
Are you ready for this? Are you ready? Are you ready for this?
That was rhetorical.
It's brilliant to make him the fall lead guy because he's not the lead guy. Sigourney Weaver is the lead guy. And to put Tom Skerritt in that role, he's the perfect guy for that role because you're thinking, well, they probably could have chosen a better actor to play the lead guy. But he's just believable enough to think, yeah, why not? Why not Tom Skerritt? And then when you realize about 20 minutes into the movie, oh no, Sigourney Weaver's absolutely the lead guy in this, then you're happy to dismiss Tom Skerritt at that point. Whereas if you would have brought in, sort of a heavy hitter for that part, that transition to Sigourney Weaver would have felt a little different.
Well, here's my retort. Uh-huh. In 1979...
Yeah. Wait, I'm not ready for it. Give me a
okay. Yeah, my bad. I did not try to get you prepped.
Okay, all right. I'm ready.
In 1979, isn't Skerritt a bigger deal than Sigourney Weaver?
Yeah, probably. I mean, I don't know their filmography, but I think that's one of the great tricks that this movie plays, is that this is going to be a female-led horror flick, and you would never know it within the first 20 minutes. And so Tom Skerritt is a really nice sort of magician's, what do you call it when a magician like shows you one hand and then does something with the other?
Sleight of hand.
Yeah. There you go. So Tom Skerritt is a really good sleight of hand.
So, well, that may be the case, but if this is a true horror flick, this actually falls right in line with the trope, right? Tom Skerritt's maybe the police officer that shows up on the scene and is, you're expecting to be the hero, but really the final girl is going to be the one that has to eventually dispatch the creature or the madman or whatever it may be. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, in many ways, it does feel prototypically horrific or horror in that regard. Maybe I'm judging a little too harshly about like people I don't care about, but I mean, like it's interesting because it does feel like you just kind of enter their world, right? And I think that's intentional. It's not like we've had a lot of backstory. We get enough idea that the grunts are feeling like they're not getting their due, because Harry Dean Stanton won't shut up about it, like. At all. Like at some point, I think you just got to just let's deal with the, like, who are you talking to about this?
I think this is more of a Parker thing. I mean, maybe the Brett character is sort of behind it, but it's the Parker character that keeps on talking about it.
No, because I think even at one point they're down there in the next time after they talk about it during the, after they're in their little galley, that they go down into the whatever, and he's just still going on about it. And I think it's like the other guy even went to stop talking about it. He was talking about something else.
No, I guess you're right. The Harry Dean Stanton character is absolutely behind the whole, labor dispute. But I feel like Parker's the mouthpiece for it. But I want to talk about that part of it too, because I really enjoyed that twist. So, you know, we talked about some of these other films that had been put out. You know, we have 2001, you know, the great, you know, exploration, but either exploration with what AI can do or exploration with what we can find out in space and what we might find out about ourselves in space. You have Jaws where it's like, let's save human life. You know, like that's the absolute motivation of the characters. Like, we can't let this monster eat innocent people. You know, Star Wars is like the key motivation for these characters is let's do right by our friends.
Mm-hmm.
What's the primary motivation for this crew? It is to make money. This is
get the job done.
It is capitalist driven. They have to abide by their contract. And that's the thing that gets them into trouble. They want better bonuses, but they absolutely have to abide by that contract. And so the motivating factor in itself is part of the horror flick. And I enjoyed that part.
Right. And the whole detour which really, I mean, you don't get a sense that anybody would have been on board with it. Like, everyone's reluctant about it, but because their paycheck is essentially at stake.
Yeah.
And so that is interesting, right? So, I mean, that is a good twist in the sense that these aren't heroes because they're heroic. They're in this situation because that's the task that was handed to them.
And I think this goes back to your elevator pitch, right? So why do we care about these people? I mean, we know why we care about the people in Star Wars, right? Because they care about each other and they're likable people. You know, they want to save the galaxy. And we know why we care about the people in Jaws, because they're vulnerable. They're raw humanity. These people they're motivated by money. So why do we care about them at all? And I think I care about a few of these guys more than others. I mean, I absolutely care about Sigourney Weaver by the end of the film, or else it wouldn't work. Are you saying you don't even care about Sigourney Weaver?
I'm not saying I don't care about Sigourney Weaver. I'm just, I guess when I say don't care about, what I mean is these are people that you wouldn't care about.
That's right. Yeah.
That doesn't mean that we don't care about them in this instance. Mm-hmm. Because ultimately this would be like, if this was not in space.
And they're not friends. They're not a family.
This could be an office.
Co-workers that like are tolerating each other. Right?
It could be an office where they're like, yeah, we're here for the weekend. We've got to do this other task. I just got this instructions that if we want to get our bonus, we got to go and go up into the, you know, to the attic, and we got to look for some files. Oh, this is just a clerical thing. This is ridiculous. And then they go up there and they encounter some sort of creature. Which, by the way, I just wrote a movie.
All right. So part of the reason I care about Sigourney Weaver is the cat. It's the cat.
All right. Put a pin in that. I'm going to come back to that. You do your thing, and I'm going to tell you why the cat may be a problem.
Okay. All right. I think that there is a problem, and I think that you've got your finger on the pulse of the problem, and that is we need a reason to care about these people. Because they're motivated by money, they don't really like each other. So why are we, you know, why do we? They're being commanded by some sort of AI thing called Mother,
right?
So it's not even their leader is sort of this soulless machine. Why do we care about these people? And the answer is maybe we don't. But by the end, Sigourney Weaver has to show her humanity in some way, and her care for the cat is how they get me to care for her.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I'm done. All right, I'm done. I'm all done.
The issue with the cat, it seems incongruous to me that somebody who was willing to let a coworker person die for the greater good of maintaining quarantine.
Yeah. Yes.
Would be like, oh, there's a cat loose where there's an alien loose.
Mm-hmm.
I should probably jeopardize the escape to go get that cat.
Mm-hmm.
That scene could work a whole lot better in a movie that was different prior to that.
Okay, I'm going
to. Because so I mean,
finish,
I understand.
But I've got
I understand
an answer to this.
I understand the necessity of the cat. Mm-hmm. In the grander scheme of, like you said, there's a humanization because she's been fairly cold but I don't know that she's had a relationship with this cat. I mean, the cat's main purpose has been to just for jump scares up until this point. And
I don't think so. I think she pets the cat a few times when they're eating. The cat's on the table, like sitting right next to her.
So you think she can't deal with people as well as she can deal with cats?
It's very well. That very well could be. But here's the other thing about this, that I feel like there's a transition in the movie that goes from protocol to like total chaos. So early on, everything's about protocol. They're woken up because the AI mother wants them to go explore this planet, and the big question is like, look, there's a contract. You're not going to get a better bonus. You're going to have to read your contract. If you don't go to the down to the planet, you're not going to get your paycheck. You got to read the contract. Sigourney Weaver is not supposed to let the guy in because of contamination. she's like going by protocol. Everything at that point is protocol, protocol, protocol. And everyone sort of has their duty. They've got this hierarchy of rank. And then what happens is that Ash decides he's going to break protocol and he's going to let the contaminated guy in. And at that point, Sigourney Weaver's kind of like kicking against goads. She's like, hey, what about protocol? And Tom Skerritt's like, eh, come on, come on, come on. At that point, everything goes to chaos and no one really knows what they're supposed to do. And then, of course, the chaos presents itself in another way with the actual alien on board. At that point, it becomes less about protocol and more about just holding back the chaos. And so when Sigourney Weaver goes to get the cat, it's because the rules have changed. That's my point.
The rules have changed.
Yes.
So you think she's a letter of the law, not the intent of the law?
I think that earlier in the movie, she was letter of the law. She wanted to follow the rules. And then when everything else around her, when everyone else around her kind of like throws the rules against the wall and it kind of shatters, she has to figure out how to hold back the chaos.
Okay. I just feel like that's fine. But then you just saw that this alien lays eggs into Kane.
Yeah, that's right.
The cat can't tell you what its interaction with this alien has been. You don't know anything about this alien. You don't get the cat. It seems problematic to me. I mean, I'm right there with you. I was like, oh, well, this is kind of a moment where it's like, look, this is a crisis moment. She's on the verge of being alone. Maybe the idea, like, she doesn't want to leave it. Now she doesn't want to leave anyone behind. That's a whole different, you know, like that could be a turning point for this character, but it just doesn't work for me. It's probably the only thing that really doesn't work for me because well, there's a couple things that don't work for me. This is a very obnoxious sounding movie.
Okay, wait. Before we go there, I want to say one more thing about the cat. I want to say that there's a lot of motherhood themes in this movie. And
with the AI called Mother, perchance.
Well, I'm just saying that's the way it starts, but you can name like 50 others. And it was very conscious. And what they wanted to do...
Where Ian Holm looks like he's spitting up after breastfeeding, after he gets hit with the fire extinguisher.
Indeed. Indeed. That's part of it. I mean, what they were trying to do with this film was they were trying to make 1975 men who were very insecure about their masculinity feel vulnerable deep down. You know, deep down. They were basically using feminine images to scare men in 1979. So I think that there's something about Sigourney Weaver's relationship to the cat that's important in that case. But if you don't like that, consider this. It might be a whole 6 weeks until she gets to eat again.
Yeah, well, it's the old proverb, right? Give a man a cat, feed him for a night. Teach a man the cat, feed him for a lifetime.
All right. So tell me about the music here.
Well, the music is probably the least of my... This movie is relentless for a good chunk of this film about just with the beeps and the blorps and the alarms. Mm-hmm. I mean, it is. And I think it's intentional, right? But it's unsettling almost to a point where like I was getting agitated.
Well, I think that was the point, right?
It just like for anything, like not like in scenes where like, oh, this is going to be dramatic, where it's just like, oh, they're just there. And it's just like, it's for a movie that implies, you know, a certain amount of, well, in space, no one can hear you scream. Like, well, I can hear everything. In fact, I hear too much. I think the reason why no one can hear you scream is not because space is so vast and empty, but it's because there's so much other freaking noise. It wasn't enough to make keep in mind, I like this movie. I think this movie is very effective. I think it holds up really well. I think the alien is fantastic to look at. I think
I think the big reveal at the end, where you find out that the reason why Sigourney Weaver is so on edge, is not so much because she's rigid and by the book, it's because her underwear has got to be incredibly uncomfortable the entire journey.
She's wearing like a 4-year-old's underwear.
The Nostromo issued underpants are an look. I understand you're trying to cut costs, but good Lord.
All right, so
like so was she like when they first started the journey? I assume she was 7, and then when she cryogenically woke up as an adult person, I mean, Tom Hanks' underwear in big fit better.
All right, so I think that you've already hinted at this, but let's talk about, does the movie hold up?
Oh yeah, I think so.
I mean, here's the thing about this, is that I think that part of the appreciation for this movie is that you know that it had an impact in that time and place, and its DNA gets imprinted on so many other movies, right? And like the chest burster,
mm-hmm.
It's just totally iconic. And yet, the chest burster, if you look at the chest burster, it runs away.
That's my favorite part.
It's a little bit like, you know, I don't know, like Grover when he's in his Super Grover outfit running away.
I mean, that thing is full on like one of those old race car tracks we used to have.
The Tyco?
Yeah, he's just gone. Straight gone. Yeah, I mean, as far as effects go, that's got to be like the worst effect in the whole movie.
It's the most iconic thing about the movie, though.
But you could have imagine that scene pops out of the chest, and then you just hear it scurry away, and they're looking for it. It's perfectly fine. But that thing was just running towards you, like, but as straight as can be, like it's just in one pose. It's. Just when I watch my children play with action figures, you know, and they just don't even try to make the legs move.
Yeah, I mean, it's a pretty great scene. It's an iconic scene.
Well, and the scene up until that moment, I mean, the acting that goes on in that sequence is really impressive.
Famously, I mean, this is sort of internet lore, but famously, Ridley Scott did not tell the actors what was going to happen as far as the actual effects. And so when the chest burster came out of the dummy's body or whatever, they were legitimately surprised. And I don't know why one of them at least didn't laugh, because that thing looked like a Muppet.
Yeah, with his little underbite.
I mean, I could see watching it for the first time and feeling like horrified by it, but I couldn't help but laugh.
Yeah.
So for me, okay, does it hold up? Yes, and in the same way that Jaws holds up, you know, you were mentioning in Jaws that, you know, you could see the hinge in the Jaws mouth or whatever.
Right.
For me, it was like, yeah, the chest burster is a little bit. I'll tell you what, though, that face sucker thing.
Yeah.
It's a nightmare. It is a nightmare.
That one. That's that whole. Yeah, that egg sequence.
Yeah.
It got me. Like, it was like just the whole. I was like, there's a lot of the like, what are you doing? You don't know, you know, like, why would you do that kind of a thing that goes on in horror movies. Mm-hmm. But this one, I kind of understood. You know, it's like you're there, and it's like on one hand, I mean, you'd be terrified, but on the other hand, you're like, I don't know what I'm looking at. Like, there's this sense of genuine curiosity, and he looks at it, and. You know, he doesn't know what he's about to encounter. Now, for me, I assume everything I don't understand is trying to kill me. So I have a different approach than obviously this individual. But I thought that whole sequence was, and it was done so well when it like, and then the edit, as soon as it like jumps into his face and kind of takes him down,
mm-hmm.
that whole sequence is really good. And the chest bursting out scene, that's really good to a point. Right. So, I mean, it does. That's your Jaws hinge.
Yeah.
Is the entirety of, they made the entire Alien out of the Jaws hinge at that point.
Right. I think that if you were completely shocked, let's say you're in the movie in 1979 and you're seeing that for the first time, you're completely shocked by that. So that whatever comes next, you're so disoriented. You're not going to be able to be a critic in the way that we are being critics of it.
Well, and if you recall what it was like to watch Star Wars in the theater when we were young, our expectation, without necessarily even thinking about it, our expectation for what effects on a movie screen could be, they were calibrated to a certain expectation, right? We didn't.
Yeah, you put a guy in a garbage can and give him like Michelin Man legs. You're like, yeah, that's a robot. Right.
We see stop motion Clash of the Titans scenes, and no one's like, pfft. We were just like, that's it. That's a scene. So, yeah, I think there's two things. Like I said, the effectiveness of the scene prior to it, and probably the expectation of like, I don't think there was that same degree of a critical eye. Whereas like now, like, because I mean, Jurassic Park, you know, you look at Jurassic Park at the time, and it was like, oh, what are my eyes even seeing? This is insane. These dinosaurs are there. You watch it now, even in like 4K, and I'm like, well, yeah, I mean, they're a little flat. You know, it's the coloring's different. You know, you see that. Because also that's the advantage of a rewatch, is that you look at it now with a little bit more of a discerning eye and you lose some of the magic, right, of that first experience.
My first thought when I saw the chest burster was, yeah, he's kind of cute.
Yeah, a little bit.
I was thinking, I wonder who's cuter, E.T. or this chest burster.
Well, and I thought about that a lot, actually. I was like, Why is he cute? Is he cute because he's small? And I liked the idea that I like to think that they intentionally made him a little cute because just regardless of creature, babies are always just a touch cuter.
Yeah,
they're kind of an exaggerated version.
Those little jaws with the silver teeth. I mean,
yeah, the idea that he's cute seems both authentic and contradictory. Like, at one hand, I'm like, yeah, well, he's kind of cute. I like that. I like the idea. And then it's even more interesting the fact that, oh, this thing is terrifying and it's adorable.
All right. Let's talk about how fast this thing grows up.
Yeah. I'd like to see that thing's underwear.
This thing goes from Alvin and the Chipmunk to Harry and the Hendersons in like a space of an hour.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and as far as we're understanding the time, for sure. And we see like one of its molted skin.
Yeah.
And it was like, it went from that to like, well, I guess I'm giant now.
the molted skin or whatever that Harry Dean Stanton picks up.
When he finds the alien condom.
It's actually made of condoms.
Yeah. So you were expecting it to be a little bigger, and then it's, yeah. Then it's Dikembe Mutombo.
Who is this movie made for?
I think it's a general audience, right? I think it's a general adult audience. Because I think there's something. It doesn't feel so sci-fi. I mean, it's sci-fi, but like it doesn't feel so sci-fi that you're going to get caught up in the technical side, right? And I think that goes back to what you were saying, is that, hey, these are just, they're workers. They're worker bees, essentially, right? I mean, they're on this ship, but like, and that makes them a little bit more relatable in the sense that, I mean, you have a science officer who has, but they defer to him a lot, right? You don't really, he gets a little sciencey, but a lot of it's like, hey, that's why you're the science officer. And that kind of feels like that helps a kind of like the lay person be like, yeah, I wouldn't get it either. And don't explain it to me. Let that guy figure it out.
Sure. Yeah. I think it's for people who enjoyed like 2001, Star Wars. They just thought, we need a space movie. And for some reason, space movies are selling. So let's do Jaws in space. And I think it was the exact right time for this particular movie, because 2001 is glacially slow. You know, talk about sci-fi. I mean, if you're not into sci-fi, you are absolutely not going to like that movie.
Right, and I disliked that movie so much that it almost made me hate sci-fi.
Okay, I loved it, of course, because I'm a River Run Through It kind of guy. And then, of course, you got Star Wars on the other end of it, you know, which is sort of, it's more of an action flick. I mean, you could argue it's not sci-fi at all. It's fantasy, you know.
Fantasy adventure, probably, or something. Yeah, I think fantasy is a really good way to put that, because it's sci-fi because it's in space and there's mm-hmm. robots and all that, but it does follow more of the fantasy ideals than it does.
Yeah,
I think maybe that's also maybe that's part of the reason why the prequels aren't as well regarded. I mean, there's a few reasons, but maybe it dips its toe a little bit more into science fiction in the sense that it being more political. By it trying to have some other sort of statement, it becomes less fantasy and more science fiction, and maybe that's a jarring part of for the audience that it had cultivated, right?
Well, regardless of that, this movie is like right in that sweet spot. Whereas if Star Wars was a little bit too action adventure for you, or a little bit too, you know, I don't know, Disneyland for you. And 2001 was a little bit too, I don't know, philosophical or something. This movie, I mean, this is the perfect space movie for this particular moment in film history.
No, I think so.
The other thing I want to talk about is the fact that when the alien gets into the escape pod, he's just lounging there.
Is he stuck?
He's completely horizontal, and it looks like he's on a shelf.
Yeah.
And he just needs a nap.
Yeah, what's he doing? And then like she has to like go through a variety of things to get him to spook him, to get him out.
why is he just laying there?
I don't know. I don't really know.
He could be all tuckered out, I guess.
Is he molting again, maybe?
I mean, maybe, who knows what his motivations are, a little bit weird to see him be so aggressive and then
not at all. Right. Cause he's like, it sees Tom Skerritt and he reaches right at him, you know, picking up people, slamming his second face into their face. And then he's right there next to her and he's just like,
it's like, and he's taunting her.
She's like, well, I'm going to go get changed. And he's like, well, it's fine. I'm all tangled up in here anyway. I don't know what I was thinking.
You know what? What was happening is it's not until she actually puts on clothes.
That's when he gets upset.
This is the thing. He's absolutely only going to attack bad fashion.
Apparently. Maybe he was being respectful. He's like, look, I'm going to give you a fighting chance. Look at this underwear. You can't. Yeah, I don't know. I'm glad you brought that up, because I was a lot of times like, well, it's convenient that he's just laying down and kind of caught in whatever that was. Like, he actually had to go out of his way to hide in that. Dude, you've been fine up until this point.
The mouth within a mouth is really cool. I'm going to say that right away. But
why?
But why does it look like a piss dispenser?
It comes out so. Yeah, I mean, it doesn't. I mean, it's interesting about the alien. It's like it feels. And I think it's intentional, if I remember looking at some of the artwork. But it feels like it's organic with a touch of like metal, right?
Yeah, it looks a little metal. But the teeth also look a little metal-y.
Right.
And its blood is acid, so it does feel like.
But its drool is not.
That's true. Yeah, whatever it is. Okay, Steve, is this movie better than a Ron Howard flick?
Yes.
Okay, I agree. What is your Howard rating?
I think it's a Howard plus three.
Howard plus three. I'm going to go Howard plus five.
Okay, that's fair.
Because of the place it occupies in movie history, I'm gonna give it even a couple notches above Howard plus three.
I like it.
I was genuinely grossed out by the face sucker.
Yeah.
To me, that was the scariest part of the film.
No, I think I think that by creating they create a landscape, they create a setting that in and of itself is like it's what is it, and I think this is, bears repeating, like how you can really put together this sort of like capitalist venture. It's just a job. Like, this is the future, and it sort of like kind of takes some of the romance out of space and sci-fi a little bit.
Sure.
Where yeah. It's like, you know, what would we do as a people if we had the ability to create these massive ships, and
we would immediately send galaxies? Truckers to space.
We would find a way to to make commodity exchange. We would turn it into something profitable, and there would be people that worked in it in such a way that, you know, it's like, instead of it being these heroic fighter pilots and space guardians, it's just, yeah, I'm a mechanic that works on this. It's like a cruise ship or something, you know. So it's I think that's kind of interesting how they demystified space at the setting. Like, the setting of it is, it's just a job. But then they incorporate then what would be like sort of the magic of sci-fi and space. Like, there's an alien, right? There's a different creature, and then on top of it, it's one that's just it's hell bent on destruction. And these people are not they're not trained for this, right? So your thought would be, well, if you're in space fighting aliens, you're probably trained to fight in space against aliens. And the fact that these folks weren't, and it was almost like the perfect kind of scenario to acquire a space alien, because you're like, look, it'll get on board because these are people, and they will let it on board, most likely. And look, we don't care if anybody comes back. We just want the ship to come back. So you have it on autopilot and all that. And so I think that's an interestingly different, horrific notion than even the alien, right? It's the whatever plot was behind this, whether the alien was good, bad, or whatever, they didn't care. That this was really just a way to get the alien. I mean, that part becomes like, that's the horror within the horror, right?
Mm-hmm. There's a lot of parallels here with Star Trek, just the whole sort of like the bridge crew, you know, the different, you know, you got the engineers, you got the science officer, you got the captain, you got the arguments between the first officer and the captain. But it's almost like the anti-Star Trek. It's like everything's dirty. Everything is kind of gross. These are like, these humans have not figured out anything. It's not like they're beyond commerce. It's a vision of the future that's really dirty.
Right.
So I recently watched the director's cut of this movie, and I liked it. And there was one major change at the end that I think improved the movie. So do you remember in Aliens when they find the humans that are basically being used as cocoons?
Yeah.
And I think one of the guys says, kill me. You know, he wakes up and says, kill me, or something like that.
Right.
Okay, so that is a premise for the deleted scene that I saw in the director's cut. When she's about to escape, and when she leaves, she goes into this little cocoon area that the alien has set up, and you actually see Tom Skerritt in that cocoon. I don't know. He's still alive, basically.
Interesting.
And he's been all cocooned up, and then he says, kill me, and she kills him with a blowtorch. And I thought, you know what? That might solve the cat problem. Because if she leaves because, I don't know why, you know, if she leaves to go do that, to kill Tom Skerritt, or to find him and kill him or whatever, it's not like she has to leave because of the cat. You could do that in a way where she thinks, well, maybe I could still save Dallas.
Like if you heard him call out or something.
Something like that.
She goes up there. Yeah. She goes up there, sees that. Now you know she's up there to save him, or at least potentially.
He says, kill me. That's always a really effective, gross thing.
Yeah.
And she does, and then she goes back, and now the alien is taking a nap.
Right. There we go.
There you go. There you go, right there. So, I don't know. I think Ridley Scott wanted to include that. And I don't think that a lot of fans think of that as canon. But I enjoyed. I enjoyed the director's cut.
Is that the only major difference that you can recall?
That was the only one I found. And then I went online and someone pointed out that she's sort of more definitive on not letting the Kane character back into the ship. Gotcha. But I felt like the theatrical cut was pretty adamant as well.
Yeah, so. I would be curious to see what that looks. I definitely thought that was pretty clear.
Yeah, I think that they told that part of the story pretty well. She was the only one that wasn't going to do it. And they overrode her, you know, her instructions to do it. So, all right, one more little thing about this movie. I learned that this part, the Sigourney Weaver part, was originally meant for a male character.
Was that right?
And they decided to put her in the role, but they didn't change much of the lines. So I wonder, like, in retrospect, sort of Sigourney Weaver's Ripley in this world has become this, I don't know, feminist icon, kind of.
Right.
And I wonder if the guys who made this film were kind of feminist on accident.
Hmm.
Like, you know, maybe they sort of created something that was important but didn't know really what they were doing.
Interesting. Yeah, I mean, again, like I would have assumed that they did that intentionally because they were following the horror trope. But
well, I mean, clearly they decided to do all these motherhood themes throughout the film, and so maybe that's why they decided to actually make the main character a mother type. I could see why someone like Sigourney Weaver would have been important to bring on, but then choosing not to change the lines at all—that's that's right. Also a conscious choice.
Huh. That is interesting. I don't know what to do with that information. I probably won't do anything with that.
Bet365 is paying out before the final whistle.
Check out Bet365's unrivaled early payout offer. When you bet on a team to win and they take a 17-point lead, you get paid no matter the final score. Forget the final whistle and start counting that cash. Hold up. You get early payout on parlays, too.
Download the app and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.